Hi everyone, and welcome back to the 13th video from the Old Testament Survey course. In this section, we'll be picking up where we left off from the last section in the book of Exodus. Therefore, we won't examine any of the background material for this book because it was covered in the last section. So we'll start by reviewing the organization of Exodus. As you'll recall, Exodus is divided into three major parts based on geographic locations. They are in Egypt, in the desert, and at Sinai. And in the last section, we covered the first two divisions of Exodus, where God delivered his people from slavery in Egypt by displaying his mighty power, and he brought them through the desert to end up camping at the base of Mount Sinai. And then in this section, we're going to cover this last major division at Sinai. In this major section is then divided into four subsections. The first subsection describes the Sinai Covenant, and the highlight of the Sinai Covenant is the Ten Commandments. Then God gives Moses detailed plans for the building of the tabernacle. The purpose of the tabernacle is to be a place for God to be present with his people. Then there's an interlude where Israel falls into idolatry. And this raises and addresses the serious question of how can a holy God be present with an unholy people? And then in the last subsection, the tabernacle is built and set up. And the result is that the presence of God remains among his people. This then is the more detailed organization of the last division of the book of Exodus. Now let's look at some of the key verses from this last section of Exodus. First is chapter 19, verses 4 through 6, where God's speaking to the people of Israel. He says, "You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt, and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations, you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." These are the words you are to speak to the Israelites. This passage is part of the prologue to the Sinai Covenant. It speaks of the special relationship into which God is bringing his people, the high calling they have, and the role that they're going to play in God's eternal plans to bless all nations. And next is Exodus 20, verse 1, where God spoke all these words. He said, "I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery." This is the first phrase of the Ten Commandments, setting the context of the commandments in the context of the covenant as a whole. See, God gives the Ten Commandments in a context of already having rescued his people and already entered into relationship with them. The next key verse is Exodus chapter 33, verses 14 through 20, which says, "The Lord replied, 'My presence will go with you, and I will give you rest.' Then Moses said to him, 'If your presence does not go with us, do not send us up from here. How will anyone know that you are pleased with us and with your people unless you go with us? What else will distinguish me and your people from all the other people on the face of the earth?' And the Lord said to Moses, 'I will do the very thing you have asked, because I am pleased with you, and I know you by name.' Then Moses said, 'Now show me your glory.' And the Lord said, 'I will cause all my goodness to pass in front of you, and I will proclaim my name, Yahweh, in your presence. I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. But,' he said, 'you cannot see my face, for no one may see me and live.'" In this passage, God promises that his presence will go with his people into the promised land. And he shows his glory to Moses. And most importantly, he proclaims and elaborates his name to Moses. And this passage goes hand in hand with the next key passage, one chapter later, Exodus chapter 34, verses 5 through 7. It says, "Then the Lord came down in the cloud and stood there with him and proclaimed his name, Yahweh. And he passed in front of Moses, proclaiming, Yahweh, Yahweh, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children and their children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation." This passage is extremely important and is quoted repeatedly in the later Old Testament and in the New Testament as well. See, God reveals and elaborates on his name and his character. Then the next key verse is not one particular passage, but it is a repeated phrase which occurs many times in many different verses. It is the phrase, "just as the Lord commanded Moses." And this phrase is repeated after describing how each part of the tabernacle was built. They built one part, "just as the Lord commanded Moses." The next part, "just as the Lord commanded Moses," etc. It emphasizes that every part of the tabernacle construction was built according to God's instructions. The tabernacle was designed by God, and Israel was required to be faithful to God's design for proper worship. In other words, God required Israel to worship him in the way that he wanted, and they were not free to make up their own rituals. And the final key verse is Exodus chapter 40, verses 34 and 35. It says, "Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses could not enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled upon it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle." The purpose of the tabernacle was for God's presence, and after it was built, God gave a tangible demonstration of his presence. His presence was with them in the tabernacle by the cloud that filled the tabernacle. These then are the main passages in this section. So now let's go on to the contents of each of the divisions of the last section of Exodus. And it starts with God making a covenant with his people at the mountain of Sinai. And like most covenant documents from this period, it starts with a prologue. And a prologue typically gives a historical summary of their previous relationship and a theological summary of their past and future relationships. It's important to recognize that God's covenant does not start with the Ten Commandments. It doesn't start with rules. You see, God had already redeemed them. He had already rescued them from Egypt. God did not command them to obey the law in order to be God's people, but they're to obey the law because they already were God's people. The law was never intended to be the way that people earn God's favor. Tim Keller said it well. Law obedience is the result of their deliverance and election, not the cause of it. And God explains his purpose for the covenant, that they would have community, relationship, and blessing. And they would be God's treasured possession. They would be a kingdom of priests. They would be a holy nation. Yes, the covenant involves obedience, but obedience is a response to God's covenant relationship, not the means of initiating or even maintaining this relationship. And the making of this covenant was accompanied by a fearful display of God's glory on the mountain for his people to see. I mean, the mountain shook. There's all sorts of evidence of God's power on the mountain. And God spoke directly to the people. They heard God's voice. And God gave the Ten Commandments, spoken aloud to all the nation of Israel with God's voice. They were written on stone tablets by the hand of God. And again, these are given after the people were already in relationship with God. And I want to suggest that the Ten Commandments are positive commands, yet they're spoken negatively. In other words, we're commanded to not do something, but that is because of a positive characteristic of God. The Ten Commandments all reflect the character of a holy, gracious, perfect God. They not only reveal how we should act, but they also tell a lot about who God is by the kind of things that he requires. The Ten Commandments are principles for living in blessing in relationship with a holy God. The first command is, "You shall have no other gods before me." Positively, this could be stated, you will be faithful to the one true God with all of your heart. You will give him the reverence and the passion that he rightly deserves. And the second command is, you shall not make for yourself an image or likeness, because God is a jealous God. Positively, we could say this is, you shall love God as he is, not as who you might imagine him to be. The third command is, you shall not take God's name in vain. Positively, this means you shall reverence God's name and you will always take him seriously. The fourth command is, you shall remember the Sabbath and keep it holy. Positively, this means You shall rely on God, not relying on yourself and your own effort. And the fifth command is, honor your father and your mother. Positively, this means you will honor authority. Don't be selfish and rebellious. The sixth command is, you shall not murder. Positively, you shall value life and do not take it unjustly. The seventh command is, you shall not commit adultery. Positively, this means you shall value faithfulness. The eighth command is, you shall not steal. Positively, we could say, you shall value honesty, respect others' property, and trust God to provide all your needs. The ninth command is, you shall not bear false witness. That is, you shall not lie. Positively, you shall value honesty and you shall speak the truth. And the 10th command is, you shall not covet. Positively, this means you shall be content and you shall trust God to satisfy you. Notice that the first four commands address our relationship with God, and the last six commands address our relationship with one another. And the first and the 10th command are the framework for all 10. In other words, we never break any command unless we break the first and 10th commandments. No sin ever happens unless we reject God and desire something else more. And no sin happens unless we covet something that God has not given us. We love it more than we love God. Then after God audibly speaks the Ten Commandments, the people beg Moses. They say, we don't want to hear God directly. He's too awesome. We'll be overwhelmed. So Moses, you go hear from God and then communicate it to us. They were afraid to hear from God directly and demanded a mediator. And then the next few chapters, up through chapter 23, verse 19, this is called the Book of the Law. And there are specific commands that elaborate and explain the Ten Commandments. In the words of your textbook, the Book of the Law tells the demands of having a relationship with God, establishing clear and uplifting instruction. And God then promised that His angel would go before them to bring them to the Promised Land, which brings to the covenant ceremony, where Israel promised to keep all the requirements of God's covenant that they'd been given. And the covenant was sealed by sprinkling blood on both parties. It was sprinkled on the altar, which represented God, and it was also sprinkled on the people, similar to the kind of symbolism in the covenant ceremony with Abraham in Genesis chapter 15. And the scripture describing the covenant ceremony says, when Moses went and told the people all the Lord's words and laws, they responded with one voice, "Everything the Lord has said, we will do." Moses then wrote down everything the Lord had said. He got up early the next morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain and set up 12 stone pillars representing the 12 tribes of Israel. Then he sent young Israelite men, and they offered burnt offerings and sacrificed young bulls as fellowship offerings to the Lord. Moses took half of the blood and put it in bowls, and the other half he sprinkled on the altar. Then he took the Book of the Covenant and read it to the people. They responded, "We will do everything the Lord has said. We will obey." Moses then took the blood, sprinkled it on the people, and said, "This is the blood of the covenant that Yahweh has made with you in accordance with all these words." Now let's take a brief digression to examine the purpose of the law. Why was the law given? What was its purpose? And by extension, what is the relationship of the Old Testament law to a modern Christian? Do we have to obey Old Testament laws? Should we ignore them? How do we know which is which? Well, this is a complicated field that people debate all the time. But let me give you a few insights. I hope they're helpful. I would suggest it's necessary to understand the function of the law to the Israelites at Sinai, and then we can better determine how they might apply to us today. First, as I mentioned, the law was never intended to be the way to earn God's favor, to come into relationship. You do not become the people of God by obeying the law. Never have, never will. You don't become saved by obeying the law. Remember, they were already saved from Egypt and already in covenant relationship with God before the law was even given. You know, to illustrate, you don't take out the trash in order to earn your wife's love, but you take out the trash because you already have your wife's love and you love her and you want to make her happy. Now, some people in Jesus' day misunderstood the purpose of the law in this way, but he corrected them. Next, the law was given to help form their worldview. You see, Israel was fresh out of Egypt. They were still engulfed in that pagan way of looking at the world. They needed to unlearn that pagan way of thinking and change and learn the godly way of looking at the world, that this world is from the Lord and belongs to the Lord, and it's for the Lord and for His people. And that's the kind of thinking that we need as well. And the law instructs them on every part of life, not only what to do or what not to do, but it also teaches the way the world really is. And the law reveals God's character. Let me illustrate this with a little story. Imagine you overhear a father talking to his son, and he says, "Son, do whatever it takes to get ahead in this world. It's all about the money and power and pleasure. Therefore, lie, cheat, steal, backstab your friends if you have to, in order to get what you want." And then you hear a different father saying to his son, he says, "Son, it's important to be honest, kind, virtuous, and loving. Being a good moral person is the most important thing in life." Now, from these two conversations, of course, you've learned what each father wanted their son to do, but didn't you also learn a whole lot about the character of the fathers as well? You see, in the same way, what God requires from his people reveals the kind of God that he is, what he likes, what he dislikes. The law is ultimately a revelation of God, and therefore it gives a correct mindset about all reality. And the law clearly shows who is the boss. God determines right and wrong, not us. God did not invite his people to negotiate the stipulations of the covenant, but they were given as commands from their covenant Lord. And the law is an expression of his lordship. And of course, the law teaches his people how to live in covenant with him. You know, sometimes a guy will complain that he doesn't know what his wife really wants. But with God, there's no mystery. He has clearly laid it out. This is what you should do. This is what you should not do. The law tells us what God is like and what he wants. And it also tells us what we are like and what is best for us. And therefore, the law also functions as protection for his people. In other words, it keeps his people from destroying themselves. You know, imagine a world in which everybody steals and kills and dishonors their parents, etc., that society would fall apart. See, when anything goes in a society, everything eventually does go. So God gave rules to protect people from themselves. And finally, the New Testament does tell us that the law points forward to Christ. We learn in hindsight. Because the law shows a need for a Savior, because we are unable to faithfully keep the law. Galatians chapter 4 tells us that the law is a schoolmaster that leads us to Christ. These then are the things the law is intended to accomplish and what we should seek to gain from the law. Now let's go back to the Exodus story. The next division of Exodus gives detailed plans and elaborate description of the tabernacle that they were about to build in the wilderness. First, they took offerings for all the materials to build the tabernacle, and most of these came from the treasures of Egypt that were given to them before they departed. The first thing it describes is the Ark of the Covenant. This is basically a wooden box that then is overlaid with pure gold, and it symbolizes God's throne, actually the footstool of God's throne. See, God is not in the box, but he symbolically dwells over the box. And the box contains a copy of the Ten Commandments, a jar of manna, and Aaron's staff that budded. A story you'll see in the book of Numbers. And the ark is a symbol of God's presence in the tabernacle. Next thing it describes is the table. And the table's made of wood covered in gold as well. And it symbolizes the benefits of God's presence. And every week it's supplied with bread, fresh bread every week. And therefore it's a symbol of God's provision. The next thing described is a seven-branched lampstand called the menorah. Menorah is a word that means lampstand. And this serves the practical function of providing light inside the tabernacle. But it's also a symbol of God's light, truth, and guidance. Next is described the tent itself. It is made of gold-covered wood walls, covered over with curtains of different kinds. And the tent is a symbol of separation and holiness, separating God's holiness within from an old unholy people outside the tent. And the tabernacle itself has two compartments. The first compartment you went into is called the holy place, which contained the table, the lampstand, and the incense altar. And only priests were allowed to enter the holy place. And then further in was a second compartment that was called the most holy place, or sometimes called the Holy of Holies. And this room contained the Ark of the Covenant. And only the high priest ever entered this room, and he only did once a year. And the next thing described is the bronze altar, which is in the courtyard in front of the tabernacle. And this is the main place of sacrifice, where the sacrifices are burnt and where the blood is poured out. And around the tabernacle and altar and wash basin is a large fence enclosing the courtyard of the tabernacle. And this is also a symbol of separation and holiness, a barrier between God and the people for their protection. And then it describes the special garments that the priests are to wear. These costumes set the priest apart from other people. And there are aspects of the high priest garment that represent the people before God. For instance, there are 12 stones. Each has the name of one of the 12 tribes. And there are also other parts that represent God to the people, such as the plaque that says, "Holiness to the Lord." So that it shows that the priest was a mediator, representing God to the people and representing the people to God. The next thing described is the inauguration for consecrating and installing Aaron and his sons as priests to serve God in the tabernacle. Next is revealed the plan for the incense altar that is set up in the outer room of the tabernacle. Again, it's made of wood covered over with pure gold. And like the name states, special incense was burned on this altar right in front of the curtain of the most holy place, as close as you could get to the most holy place without actually going inside. And this is a symbol for the prayers of the people coming before God's presence. Then we see described the bronze wash basin, which was also in the courtyard in front of the tabernacle. And this is a symbol for cleansing and purity of all who enter the tabernacle. And it also served the practical function of washing after sacrifices were made and before entering into the tabernacle. Then finally, Exodus describes the people who were specially gifted by God with skill as artisans and artists to build all that had just been described. Now, just to be clear, all that has been described in this section is just the plans. None of it has yet been built at this point in the narrative. It will shortly happen, but only after an important interlude. Now, all this is good, but we don't really understand the tabernacle until we understand the reason and the purpose for the tabernacle. Why was it built? Why did God have this set up? Well, two passages in Exodus help us to see what that purpose is. The first is chapter 29, verses 44-46, which says, "I will consecrate the tent of meeting and the altar, and I will consecrate Aaron and my sons to serve me as priests. Then I will dwell among the Israelites and be their God. They will know that I am Yahweh, their God, who brought them out of Egypt, so that I might dwell among them. I am Yahweh, their God. And the second passage is chapter 33, verses 15 and 16, where Moses said, God, if you are not present with us, we don't want to go. How will the nations know that we are yours without your presence being with us? You see, the purpose of the tabernacle is for God to be with his people in their midst. But there's a problem with that, because God is too holy, too morally pure to dwell with sinful people without punishing them in his wrath. It's like carrying around radioactive material. You need something, some sort of protective barrier, or the proximity will harm you. And God is much more powerful than uranium. Therefore, the tabernacle functions for God to be present in the midst of his people, yet also separate from his people. Kind of an insulating barrier while still being in their midst. And access to the tabernacle is not open to anybody. It's guarded for their protection. And God determines the way in which people have access. Before the priest may enter the tent, the first thing is sacrifice, including death and blood. And then we see washing and purity. And the result of this access is then light, provision, and nearness of prayer. And it provides access to the footstool of the throne room of God, symbolic of God's nearness and his rule. And therefore, God's presence is with his people, but it is veiled. It is partial, because his people could not handle all of God's presence. Now, by the way, when we get to the New Testament, at the time when Jesus died, the veil of access is torn in two, so access to the most holy place is open to all. But that's getting ahead of the story. At this point, we see God's presence is scrub, all they could want or need. Psalm 16, verse 11 says that there is fullness of joy in God's presence. And that is the purpose of the tabernacle. Now, earlier, I mentioned that the plan for the tabernacle is described, and then later it is built. But between these two sections is an interlude, which is the very important theological center of this whole section. It's like the meat of the tabernacle sandwich, which gives insight to the significance of the tabernacle. And in this interlude, we see disobedience, its consequence, and God's grace. And this section is one of the most profound and most important episodes in the entire Old Testament. It starts while Moses is up on Mount Sinai receiving all the instructions for the tabernacle that we just saw. But in the meantime, the people got impatient and they fell into idolatry. Under Aaron's leadership, they created a false god in the form of a calf made of gold. They didn't know that he is Yahweh. So at the same time Moses is getting the plan for true worship, Aaron is leading them in false worship. So when Moses comes down from the mountain and he sees this, he breaks the tablets of the Ten Commandments written by God. And this symbolizes the broken covenant. The covenant is over before it ever began. So what happens? Is this the end? Is God's special relationship with this nation over? What's going to happen? Now, at first, God threatens to kill them all and start over, which he would have been totally justified in doing. But Moses intercedes for the people, begging God to forgive them and asking that God's presence would go with them to the promised land. And Moses went even further, very bold. He asked God, "Show me your glory." And God responded that he was pleased with Moses, and he promised that his presence would go with them. And he says, "I will show you my goodness." And he promised to proclaim his name to Moses, with the disclaimer that I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I'll have compassion on whom I have compassion. God remains free in his grace. We need to be careful. If grace can be demanded or forced, it's no longer grace. But God told Moses he could not see his face and live. He would only get a glimpse of the back part of his glory. First, God made Moses chisel out new stone tablets to replace the first. And then God passed by Moses and proclaimed his name. He passed in front of Moses proclaiming, "Yahweh, Yahweh, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children and their children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation." See, this is a further revelation and elaboration of the significance of the name Yahweh and the character of God. We see he is gracious and faithful, yet he is also just to punish evildoers. Do you see the problem with this? Do you see the tension? How can God be just and merciful at the same time? See, if he's just, he must punish us because of our sin and rebellion. And if he's merciful to forgive us, how can he punish evildoers? See, the rest of the Old Testament struggles with this tension, and it's not actually fully answered until we get to the New Testament. How can God be just and merciful at the same time? I think the answer to this question is summarized very well in Romans chapter 3, starting at verse 22, which says, "This righteousness from God comes through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. There's no difference, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God and are justified freely by his grace through the redemption that came by Christ Jesus. God presented him as a sacrifice of atonement through faith in his blood. He did this to demonstrate his justice, because in his forbearance he had left the sins committed beforehand unpunished. He did it to demonstrate his justice at the present time, so as to be just and the one who justifies those who have faith in Jesus." See, by the cross, God is just and the one who justified. He is just by fully punishing our sin on the cross. And he is merciful and he's forgiving by taking that righteous wrath on himself as a substitute, so that it does not fall on us who believe in him. Back to Exodus. Then God renewed the covenant that had been broken. God went back again. He restored that broken relationship even after his people were totally unfaithful. Think about how this applies to us. Think about how many times we have sinned after we are converted to Christ. Again and again and again, and we knew exactly what we were doing. See, if our Christian life is based on our performance and our faithfulness, there's no hope. But if it's based on God's character and God's work, then we are secure in him. And then the final division of Exodus describes the actual building of the tabernacle. It reviews in the same detail all of the furniture, all the construction that had been described earlier. And it emphasized all the materials that were used. And it describes again the builders who did the building. And in each section, after describing every part, it says it was built just as the Lord commanded. Again, this emphasized God's right to determine the way that he is approached, the way that he is worshiped. And then when the construction was completed, the tabernacle was set up in the wilderness of Sinai, and the glory of the Lord in the pillar entered the temple as a tangible demonstration that his presence was with them in the tabernacle. And that's how the book of Exodus ends, with God present with his people in a covenant relationship, with clearly defined laws and commandments, and with a place for his people to meet with him. So now let's transition and look at the theological themes of Exodus. The first theme we have already seen, which is the name. And we learned that God is the self-existent one, and that God is strong. Remember, he's bigger than the gods of Egypt. And God fulfills his promise. He can be depended upon. He can be trusted. And we can have faith because of his faithfulness as well as his strength. And then in this final section, it's added to our understanding of his name that he is compassionate and gracious. He is slow to anger, etc., etc. He has mercy and compassion on whom he wants. And then the second theme is still deliverance and rescue. And we've already seen this, that it involves covering by blood. And God owns his people, especially the firstborn, by right not only of creation, but also of purchase of redemption. And now we get to the third theme, a new one, which is covenant. Now we've already seen the nature of a covenant relationship. And some of the things we learn about God's covenant in Exodus are that it is grace first. God gives grace and initiates the covenant relationship before his people receive his law, let alone before they obey his law. And it involves God's grand purposes to display his name and bless the entire world. And it does involve action on the part of his people. They have their part to play. And the covenant is inaugurated with blood. Just like the covenant with Abraham and the Passover, sacrifice and blood are an integral part of the covenant initiation. See, there's no forgiveness and relationship without the shedding of blood. And then the final theme is God's presence. This is the way for the holy God to be present among an unholy people. Yet God is present with his people. By his grace, he has made a way to be so. And it's God's way of access to his presence. And they experienced the glory of God in his presence. Now, looking ahead to the New Testament, Jesus is said to be the tabernacle, the meeting place with God. And also in the New Testament, the church community is called the tabernacle, the dwelling place of God's presence in the world by his Spirit. So these are the main theological ideas that we see in the book of Exodus. So now let's review. First, the three sections of Exodus. They are in Egypt, in the desert, and at Sinai. And the theological themes of Exodus are the name, deliverance, rescue, covenant, and presence. NDCP, if that's a helpful memory device. Well, that concludes the book of Exodus. one of the most important books of the Old Testament. And in the next section, we'll move on to look at the next biblical book, which is Leviticus. Thanks for watching.
All pay heed! The Lord Jehovah, has given unto you these 15... Ten commandments for all to obey.